Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Let's have a look at the front pages first. The Sunday Times leading with pilots threaten all-out strike at Aer Lingus. So they have an interview with Captain Mark Tighe, and he is, I would say, pretty bullish in this. He said the pilots' position has become more resolved and entrenched. He says, I don't think they, meaning Aer Lingus management, can budge without admitting they got it wrong. So there's talk of off-ramps in the papers today. That doesn't sound like anyone giving anyone an off-ramp right now anyway. And their off-lead is Fine Gael order hints at election this year. So this story is elsewhere as well. Hugh O'Connell writing that Fine Gael has ordered all general election candidates to be selected before the end of September. And he is speculating that this is one of the first concrete signs the coalition is preparing for a poll this year. The Sunday Independent is leading with the funerals of Micheála Mór Hortig and Tommy Gorman, and their off lead is also Aer Lingus. Look, everyone's spinning everything here now. So naive quote, pilots lost fight, say sources. This is well-placed sources saying that Aer Lingus pilots and IALPA have already lost their fight. That's Fergal O'Connor, and there's more on that, and we'll come to that. The Business Post have a poll. Their headline out of that is Fine Gael now largest party as Fianna Fáil jumps 4 points. The Irish Mail on Sunday is leading with Harris resists call to move to Phoenix Park. So this is Taoiseach Simon Harris, and this is after various threats and incidents outside his home that security may want him to move into this steward's house in Farmley in Phoenix Park, which is technically an official residence for the Taoiseach of the day. The Sun on Sunday is leading with Danny O'Donoghue from The Script, who was on the show yesterday, and the headline there is Danny, I quit booze and found God, and that is after his best friend and bandmate Mark died, and he actually was terrific in how he expressed grief and everything else. If you want to find that interview, find it on the RT app or wherever you get your podcasts. And the Mirror, farewell to RT legend, granddad of our nation, and that's Micheála Mór Hortig's coffin being carried out of the church there. Okay, our panel today, Margaret E. Ward is a leadership consultant and a former journalist. Professor Bridget Laffin is Emeritus Professor at the European University Institute and the Chancellor of the University of Limerick. Gráinne Nié is a news reporter with the Press Association, and Dan O'Brien is Chief Economist at the Institute of International and European Affairs. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Okay, let's start. There's a lot to fix here. Dan, you picked Colin Murphy's piece in the Sunday Independent about Joe Biden, which remains a big talking point today.
Yeah, so Colin Murphy comes to the conclusion, rightly, that in my view, that this was a sort of Lehman Brothers moment. You may recall that was an American bank that collapsed and caused the global financial crisis of 2008. That this, the interview on, or the debate on Thursday, was a complete catastrophe for Joe Biden, and that he's not fit to run again, and that the Democrats need a new candidate.
Did we find out anything new about Joe Biden on Thursday night? Was anyone expecting?
Well, I think anybody who's been following it sees that clearly, an 81-year-old, 82-year-old man is in decline. Is anybody, that's been abundantly evident. But when it came to a sort of long duration debate, it was, nobody, not even his strongest supporters, could say that this was not a man in decline. And who will be, if he were to win the election, America would be the president until early 2029. Now, to do that job well into your 80s from where he is now, it just doesn't look feasible.
Margaret E. Ward, are you a card-carrying Democrat?
I am a card-carrying Democrat since age of 18 in New York. I grew up in a very conservative Republican town, and they used to call me the something Democrat. Okay. I was the only Democrat in the town.
Okay. Do you feel like the only Democrat in the town right now? So... What are your thoughts?
I think this is a storm in a teacup. I don't think that they're going to change horses midstream. It's a big thing in American politics. Do not change horses midstream. I think he did not perform well, but I still think Trump was lying the entire time. And we're just so used to that now, just that this man lies, that we're more focused on Joe Biden looking frail. And he is an 81-year-old man, but Trump is, what, 78 years of age? And he's a compulsive liar who's a threat to democracy. I mean, okay. I don't know why we're not focusing on that more.
Well, why aren't the Democrats focusing on that? Why was the Democrat narrative after that debate not what you just said now? I mean, a few of them tried to say it, but mainly it was the Democrats the bed here and went into to a meltdown.
I agree. I mean, I don't think the Democrats have handled Trump well at all for a long, long time. And I think that that's one of the biggest problems, that the parties in the United States are weak. The Democratic Party is weak and the Republican Party is weak, because the Republican Party is now a cult of personality. Nobody wants to speak out against this guy who, you know, we know is going to be an authoritarian president if he gets in. I think it's likely he gets in. I do, and it's terrifying to me, but I think it's very likely, no matter who is up against.
You don't think anyone could beat him, no?
I think the best chance is Biden. And the polls in the United States are showing that the voters who were going to vote for Biden or Trump after that debate are still going to vote for Biden or Trump. It hasn't made any difference.
Yeah, I think 3% in one direction, 2% in the other or something, but it does seem to be negligible. But back to, like, the Democrats then created this catastrophic narrative themselves around it. We agree that now, do we? Yeah.
At least on the day they did, but then after that, I think then you saw a lot of people going, oh, but why aren't we focusing on Trump? But it was hours afterwards. I mean, it should have been an immediate thing.
Was there an issue with CNN as well, and how that debate was conducted, that this was allowed to happen? Like, how does Trump, because he's confident in his lying, gets away with it for the whole time?
Yeah, basically. I mean, why wasn't he being fact-checked the entire time? They could have easily put stuff up on screen saying untrue. Biden should have called him out on it, but more than anything, you know, it was the role of the presenters to call him out, and they didn't.
Well, I think what was said going into the debate was it would be the role of the opponent to call out and fact-check.
I don't know if I agree with that. I think it is the role of the media also to fact check, and even in a live debate. But I have questions about the format of the debate. If you know that you have a 78-year-old and an 81-year-old, say they're your parents, would you allow them to stand up for 90 minutes without a seat?
Okay, if you have a 78-year-old and an 81-year-old and they were your parents, you mightn't recommend that they be the president of America.
Well, maybe we start with that. Yeah. It depends on who your parents are. But I mean, why didn't they let them sit down? Why didn't they do it more kind of, you know, a sit-down style so that they didn't have to stand? Just out of consideration for the age of the candidates. You know, they are 78 and 81.
Yeah, but if they can't stand up for an hour, but they can be the president of America?
Well, there are a lot of people, you know, who can't stand up, who are in wheelchairs
and others, who are perfectly
fine from a mental and intellectual point of view.
Okay. Bridget?
So a disaster, but also very poignant. I mean, it was awful to watch, terrible to watch. And you can imagine the attack ads just running and rerunning. But I agree somewhat with Margaret in that changing horse now is actually extremely difficult, because firstly, the Democrats would have to agree an alternative. There is no clear alternative easily or quickly available. Kamala Harris has not shown. And then they have until the 19th of August to the convention in Chicago. And what would be the worst for the Democrats is they go into Chicago and have an implosion and a disaster. So I would say,
now, some Democrats are saying that this could be, and Colin McCann was kind of echoing this a bit yesterday, that it could be very exciting. It could feel like not an implosion, but an explosion of democracy if the Democrats suddenly decided, let's deal with this.
But those implosions rarely work out, rarely work out well. You see the bodies on the ground and the blood flows.
Okay, so a controlled explosion.
So either they change, but they need to get their act together. And I think the only people who can do that are the grandees of the Democratic Party and Joe Biden himself. He would have to come to the realization he needs to step down. Or they go all out offensive against Trump. But going offensive against Trump is not that easy because the normal rules of politics don't seem to apply to him. Usually if you're a felon, you lie. I mean, his history, it's not as if we don't know Trump. Normally he would just simply not be fit for office and not able to stand. But that base he has is very strong. But one then has to ask, and of course it will come down to four or five states, who are the swing voters, and they're the independents, and would they vote for Trump in the end? So I just don't know, but all I say is it terrifies me because this isn't just a problem for American democracy. It is a very serious problem for our world.
Gráinne, I'll come to you in a second, okay? I just want to go back to Margaret on something Bridget said there, which is that they could go on the all-out attack against Trump, but you can't really.
You can't. No, you can't.
You can't attack this man.
You know, one of the things that I am most disappointed in Joe Biden about is his treatment of Kamala Harris. OK, so if you look at leadership, leaders will have a succession plan or should have an succession plan years before they plan to leave an organization, a business, politics. And why was Kamala so invisible the minute that he was elected? I mean, she should have absolutely been groomed to become president of the United States, and he didn't do that.
You think it's his fault?
I think it is his fault. And I think just like, Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
She hasn't shone when she was given her chances, is the general consensus,
You know, how much of a chance did he give him? I think there's an ego issue here with Joe Biden for not stepping aside. I mean, I think he should have said, no, she's your next president of the United States. She's well able. He should have given her loads of opportunities on all different stages if he really backed her for more than just getting the votes.
Did he not say when he ran first, I'll be the bridge?
He did, from what I recall.
A one-time president who was going to be the bridge to the next generation, a holding position to keep Trump out and then pass the torch.
But so it's like his ego. So if we look at Ruth Bader Ginsburg, another example, I mean, a huge hero of mine, she should have retired earlier so that we would have had an opportunity to put a less conservative person on the Supreme Court. And she didn't do that. And that meant, you know, what happened to the United States happened in terms of birth control and abortion. And I'm hugely disappointed as a lifelong member of the Democratic Party in Joe Biden in his lack of succession planning.
Gráinne.
So I think there has been a lot of talking about Joe Biden's age, and a lot of Democrats came out after the debate and said he had one job during that debate, and it was to show that he was able for the job. And when there's clips of social media where he looked frail, you can't argue with an hour debate or an hour and a half that there was no clips to look manipulative or anything. And I think that really hit people. And I think the problem is not the core voters that are going to vote. I think there was a poll after the debate that showed 60% thought Trump won the debate and 30% thought Biden won the debate, which I think says a lot about the core base on both sides that just will not shift no matter what. But it's the undecideds that I think will be swayed by what happened during that debate and where they go. Biden was so frail and so bad at arguing with Trump, and there was a lot to hit on. There was his stance on abortion, which is still not clear, and there is obviously the conviction, but he did not land because the focus was too much on his delivery and his stance.
Put it on the agenda, he kind of took it off again and burbled it.
And by default, it made Trump look competent. And I think the style of the debate was another thing. It was meant to stop people arguing, and so they stuck to time and there was equal time, and to stop Trump cutting in on Biden. But actually, it made Trump look measured and composed instead.
I think the most damning thing there is those clips of Trump just sitting there looking and letting him talk. It's just appalling stuff, really.
And then I think it was very telling that one of the most fiery parts of the debate, where they argued over each other's golfing abilities, where it was like, this is the most passionate thing both of you are getting worked up about. Go do that. Don't run for the presidency. Go enjoy your private lives and stop trying to represent the normal people of America.
Dan.
We need a plan in this country. Because it's more likely than not, Trump will be re-elected. He's made it very clear what he's going to do.
Yeah.
Just in economic issues for us alone, we face a huge challenge. We are by far the biggest exporter of pharmaceuticals to the United States and the world. No, they get a quarter of their pharmaceuticals that they import into the United States from this country. That's bigger than any other country. Trump has promised to put a tax of 10% on everything that comes in. Now, that may mean that the companies that make pharmaceuticals in this country find that it is better to shift production to the United States and make those drugs there. Now, that's just one risk. And we saw Brian Carey in the Sunday Times mentions that there's a Danish company that has decided not to invest here and go to the United States. Now, maybe that's a sign of things to come. But if Trump follows through on what he says he will do if he's elected, and he now looks likely to be elected, we are facing severe economic challenges, never mind the security issues around Russia and Ukraine war. So we need a plan of this country around similar to how we plan for Brexit, because this is going to be massive.
Okay, Bridget.
Exactly that. We set up a Brexit preparatory group way before we knew more about Brexit than the British did. This is, in fact, I would say, of a higher order of magnitude in terms of risk to the country.
Okay, let's go to domestic politics now, and the opposite end of the age spectrum, Gráinne. Jack, be nimble, Jack, be quick. in tray for new finance minister, piling up ahead of crucial budget is Conall Thomas in the Business Post.
Yeah, Conall is writing about Jack's kind of the challenges facing him as a finance minister.
This is Jack Chambers.
Chambers, of course, the 33-year-old Dubliner who's taking over the financial portfolio. And as the piece says, Jed Nash of Labour said, being a young minister for finance will not matter if he's as conservative as the rest. So just because he's young does not necessarily mean we're going to get a radical shift in financial matters.
What are the, Gráinne, what's your read on the politics of this? There's a lot of variations on theories around the papers today that... This is Micheál Martin. I think who is it suggesting that he is cementing his control of the party? It's Hugh O'Connor.
Hugh O'Connell has a piece in the Sunday Times where he talks about, he quotes kind of various, it's a very good piece, but he talks about unhappiness among female members of the party about no female candidate being promoted during the Fianna Fáil mini reshuffle, and a fatigue with that. He also talks about sending Michael McGrath, who was seen as a leadership contender for the party, to Europe, and promoting Jack Chambers, who is also viewed as a leadership contender, but not now, kind of solidifies his position in the party. And one backbencher, I think, said that the moves were being made in Micheál Martin's interest. Now, the argument against that would be what has good for Micheál Martin seems to be good for the party because he is doing so well in leadership polls and that kind of thing. But I think it suggests that it is like a consolidation of power. And Hugh O'Connell in the Sunday Times points out that he has been in charge of Fianna Fáil for longer than Bertie Ahern and Charles Haughey, which I think would take a lot of people by surprise.
Yes, yes. And then the theory floating around that he was basically anointing Jack Chambers to take over the party before the presidential election in 2025, so that Micheál Martin goes to the piece said
running for the Oris, he would be a shoo-in, and it would appeal to Micheál, the historian, and Micheál Martin. And we've seen how popular he is. I was out canvassing during the local elections, and a couple of people we spoke to at the door said, I never thought I'd vote Fianna Fáil, but I really like Micheál Martin. And these are people who are renters as well as young homeowners who are struggling with the cost of living. So I thought that was quite interesting.
Bridget, the piece you picked about Jack Chambers is Matt Cooper, my advice to the new finance minister, be bold, think big.
And what was interesting about that piece is he did a reprise of various finance ministers, McSharry, McCreevy, Quinn, and assessed them. But then he went on to say that rather than tinkering with the increasing the entry
tax
level to the tax bands,
just do something
about the USC, that would be a better headline grabber and be more popular. But the reality is Jack Chambers is a one budget minister, and it's the election budget. In the end of the day, he's now going to have to work with Pascal Donoghue. And there, I would say from the polls this morning, it's clear there's an autumn election coming. So this is a one-off But I do think it is also to do with internal dynamics in Fianna Fáil. But it's not...
What do you speculate those dynamics are?
And
this is pure speculation.
I'm not so sure Micheál Martin would want to go to the park in 2025. I think my view is he wants to stay
another
for longer. And he would see now, on the basis of the polls this morning, that he will either beat Taoiseach or share it with...
Okay, but look, and there was other foregone conclusions 6 months ago. So
he was going to Europe, and he didn't want to go. In the end, he didn't. I never thought he was going to Europe.
Okay, Dan. There's no doubt Jack Chambers is, by all accounts, a very bright young man, a law degree, a qualified doctor, and everything. It is kind of odd in this country, and when you look back in the history of finance ministers, that people who don't necessarily have any qualifications in economics, finance, or whatever are put in charge of the national purse.
Yeah, that's the system I suppose we have here. Many countries, you know, people who have cabinet ministers are not in parliament. Often you can't be in parliament and double job. You can't be a parliamentarian. The American system, for example. I personally think that's a better system. Being a parliamentarian and a minister at the same time are two big jobs. So that's our system. And because we have that system, we've always done it. It means invariably that you've got a very small pool of TDs on the government side. So you are very often have people who with no background in the area that they're dealing with. That's our system, as I say. I think there are better systems, but that's how it is.
Would you agree with Bridget that it possibly doesn't matter hugely because this budget will be what it will be and it's one budget?
Look, this is a pre-election budget. The public finances are in reasonable shape. The other issues we could quibble about, but there's cash to spend and they're not going to leave much in the coffers.
One more question to Dan. So would you approve of then a budget that gives away again? You know, people got a fair chunk back in the budget last year. Is that the way to go?
As an economist, you know, to when you've got an economy that's at full capacity, growing well, you don't want to fan the flames, particularly when we've got inflation.
Yeah, but
problems.
Are you not fanning the flames by giving people more money back?
No, putting more money into the economy gives people more money and means pushes prices up. So it inflates things when you already have an inflation problem.
A giveaway budget then is not a good idea right now?
It's not a good idea. No.
Oh, yeah.
It's not a good idea.
Oh, okay.
Clearly, the economics of this won't come into it. This is a pre-election budget and, you know, money will be spent. As an economist, I would say that is not a good idea, but clearly the politics will override the economics.
It's interesting to note that we have a minister for health with a business background and now a finance minister with a health background. And then when we get into the discussions about where money will go, what that might mean. You know?
Yeah. They do say, don't they, that people who come from a different discipline into another discipline can actually be really, really good because they come with a different mindset and everything. But who knows? Margaret, just staying on politics, you picked a piece in the Mail on Sunday, and I know this is a big area of interest for you. Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil in scramble for female candidates. This is John Drennan.
Yes. So if you look, Mail on Sunday, that's page 22 to 23. Now, I have been a trainer for Women for Election for the last 10 years or so. So I know firsthand how difficult it is for the parties to get their 40%, which is required coming up to the next election. This is specifically to put forward 40% of female candidates. So it's not the people who get elected, but the ones put forward. And there's been a longstanding argument that you need to have that same thing for the county councils because that is where they come from. So, they're struggling, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, to get more female candidates.
So as part of, the Women for Election is the organisation.
Yeah, and there's several.
Support women running for all parties and none.
That's right.
What is holding women back in
Well,
your experience?
Well, if you look at a study done by Ivana Vacek many, many years ago, the barriers continue to be cash, childcare, candidate selection, culture. But there's a new one, which is basically cyberbullying, right?
Yeah.
So we know that, look, anybody in the public eye, anybody in the studio, anybody in the public eye is getting harassed on social media just for daring to be in the public eye. But when you're a female politician or a female candidate, you get even worse and your family can be targeted elsewhere. But this is clearly a strategy that's being used by certain elements in our country to make sure that people women don't run for politics. And we see how Simon Harris and his family are being targeted. So those who are in politics, they want to intimidate them to get out. And that's a big threat to democracy. So we have to double down our efforts to make sure that we have more women and people from different cultural backgrounds running for politics in this country, because that is, we are a multicultural society.
Yeah.
We need it. We need more and more people.
I think it was very good in the locals to see candidates from the New Irish emerging right across the country, because it's really one of the most important things in terms of integration, that politics reflects this societal, the society that is being represented. On women, I would add, I think Irish politics is punishing in the sense that a TD has to be is the local representative and has to be so readily and easily accessible. And so if you're a woman in a certain age cohort, it's a punishing life. Also, Dublin, up and down the country, et cetera, if you don't live in Dublin. So politics, the barriers are very high. And we've seen improvements in the proportions in Ireland, but none of the breakthroughs that you've seen in other systems, which require not just 40% candidates, but have much stronger incentives. But it's very difficult constitutionally in Ireland to alter our electoral system, as we know. So the 40% candidates is the best they can do. But for women to be the tokens on the ticket doesn't do anything for women.
Yeah, and what often happens is they might field female candidates, but they field people who they think have no chance of getting elected, just as a way to be like, oh yeah, we have our 40%. And we have seen that. And sorry, I'm speaking for myself as an individual and not as Women for Election, because I just do training for them. I'm not employed by them.
Okay.
But I do think it's very important that if you are going to put a female candidate or, you know, a candidate from a different cultural background, you need to give them the best possible chance of winning.
Yeah.
And support them. Really, so they need extra support.
Okay.
They do.
Just before we go to a break, Grainne, there's a poll in the Business Post today, which is kind of interesting. Will you give us the state of the parties and the technical context of the poll as well?
Yeah, so it's a random sample of 100 adults conducted online
a thousand
adults conducted online between June the 21st and the 26th. So that's up to last Wednesday. It basically indicates that there has been kind of, there's three kind of main parties vying for the top spot. So Fine Gael is on 21%, down 1. Sinn Féin is on 20%, down 3. Fianna Fáil is up 4 percentage points to 19%. So I don't think they'll be giving out about this opinion poll. The Independents are on 15%. The Greens are on 5%, up 1 point. Sock Dems on 5%. Independent Ireland makes an entry in this poll. And they're on 5%, so they're separated out from the Independents. Labour's on 3%, down 1. People Before Profit, Solidarity are on 3%, and AINTH are on 3%. So,
What's the headline that this suggests?
There's three parties, Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, Sinn Féin, vying for the top spot, all within the margin of error. And
as 3%.
Exactly. And as Richard Colwell makes the point about the polls, and you can see it, there's a graph in the paper that illustrates at the best the trend from the last general election till now. Sinn Féin were on 36% a year or so ago, and the poll indicates that they are on 20% now. And he makes the point that you cannot compare local election and general election results. It is not reflective, because that is not where... That does not reflect the general or the local election results.
I noted them here. He makes a couple of interesting points, which is general election, Sinn Féin general election voters less likely to vote in local elections.
Yes.
Younger voters more likely to vote in the general election. And then he points out as well that in 2019, Sinn Féin 9% in the locals. 8 months later, in general election,
which
2020,
is a similar kind of
25%.
But interestingly, I think Sinn Féin face a dilemma, because they ran too few candidates in the last general election, ran too many in the locals, and now they're unsure of where they are. So they're certainly not as low as the local and European elections, but they're nowhere close to 30. So if they run too many candidates, if their vote is softer, and it appears to have softened a lot over the last period, then they may have a dilemma coming into the next election.
You need to crunch numbers, thoughts. Essentially.
Irish politics is just changing. The last four times we've gone to the polls, 2019, 20, and twice this year, nobody expected the outcomes. So I think predicting Irish politics these days is a mug's game.
really, just massive volatility,
huge.
Is it?
Like every single thing about the referendums, who thought that 75% of people would vote down those referendums? Nobody predicted that. Nobody predicted the most recent electoral outcomes. Nobody predicted the 2020 electoral outcome, least of all Sinn Féin, who did so well. 2019, nobody predicted Sinn Féin crashing in that election. I have no idea what's going on.
Okay. You're putting a lot of people out of business there now if you're going to put a fatwa on predictions. All right, we'll take a break. Margaret E. Ward, Professor Bridget Laffin, Grainne Inniu and Dan O'Brien are staying with us.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Our panel is still here. Margaret E. Ward, Professor Bridget Laffin, Grainne Inniu and Dan O'Brien, who just made, I would say, panel history possibly by admitting I have no idea what's going on anymore. Funny, more people would just stand up and say it. Violence against women, misogyny has been very much back on the agenda this week. And just Margaret, Brenda Power has a terrific piece in the Sunday Times, more an overview piece. Misogyny is the only algorithm that matters.
Yeah, quite a powerful piece. We have seen the last couple of weeks a lot on violence against women. We know that there's an epidemic of domestic violence against women and violence generally, which is increasing throughout the world as well. So we should all be on high alert for that. She talks about basically how social media and comments, she says it's not just singers and princesses. The internet seems to hate all women. And she talks about some of the conspiracy theories that have gone around. You know, so Michelle Obama apparently is a man. Natasha O'Brien's a paid actor. Taylor Swift's band Don't Play Live. You know, so all of these things are being bandied about that discount and diminish women and their accomplishments. And unfortunately, you know, social media, she says, really hates women. It hates them when they're being strong and bulgy, and hates them even more when they're weak and vulnerable. And if you were to define the entirety of social media by a single algorithm or one single ruling governing the operation of a global platform, it'd be misogyny.
Do you think
misogyny sells?
Do you think, Margaret, that we were making progress
I
as
do.
A culture and a society,
yeah.
and that actually the internet and social media has dragged us back to
I do. And
previous
it's,
age?
It's when I worked in New York in the late 80s, early 90s, and I worked for one of the first internet service providers called Prodigy. And when people would say, what are you working on? And I'd say, the internet. And they'd go, that's never going to work. You know. And at the time,
right.
when we were working on it, and I was a journalist, they were right. They were right, right? Human nature. They
you
were
should,
right.
You should have killed it stone
really
dead
work.
Then. Yeah.
And we thought of it as this great experiment in democracy and connecting people around the world and allowing them to speak, you know. And we heard about the fall of the Berlin Wall before anybody else because we had bulletin boards and we were talking to people in Berlin about what was going on. It was this amazing beacon of hope. But of course, what happens? You put humans in the mix, and you put corporations in the mix who want to make money. So the way the corporations are making money is that the algorithms push you towards more and more extreme content. And they've shown this particularly.
So high engagement.
High engagement is what they want.
High engagement tends to be associated with
it does.
More
so, and it's
stuff.
Not just social media companies. I mean, we have to talk about pornography and all of this misogyny, how young men and young boys' brains and men's brains are being rewired with the violence and the degradation against women that they see every single day on pornographic websites. And young children age 7 and 8 are seeing this. And we are visual creatures. If you see something, you don't forget it. It rewires the brain. So
okay.
misogyny and violence against women is a huge issue in Ireland globally. And we have to tackle it. We have to be progressive and we have to be proactive or it will continue.
Okay. And obviously, Grainne, we can't shut down the internet at this stage or clean it up or anything. But you picked Julian Maloney in the Sunday Independent. She's kind of talking about the culture broadly as well. Understanding what drives men to be violent to women is vital. She's not in any way being an apologist for men, but...
No, she makes the point that it's not about what she calls it, himpathy, which is, you know, this kind of concept about unfair assumptions that predispose decision makers to cast a forgiving eye over criminal acts. It's not about that. It's about understanding it so it can be tackled properly. And she makes the point that custodial sentences are shown statistically to reduce the likelihood of reoffending. She also makes the point that, you know, sometimes when you see women out on marches or people calling for a focus on equal rights for women, that sometimes the refrain back to that is, well, you are equal, there is equality, what more do you want? But actually, an Oxfam analysis of 70 countries over 40 years has found that the most vital and consistent factor for driving policy change is feminist activism. So it should not be seen as something that is done or something that doesn't make a difference. Being out in the streets and getting in touch with TDs and senators, especially if we have more TDs and senators who are women, makes a difference. I suppose it's also kind of important to say that men are not, and people in general are not, born abusers or criminals. Like, this is something that is impressed upon them throughout the factors around them.
You think it's the socialisation of,
absolutely,
of men a lot, and then circumstances
online. The way we are influenced online in ways we don't even know it is something that I think is going to really come to the fore. There was a podcast out who trolled Amber about Amber Heard and the Johnny Depp trial, which people may have been following. And a lot, once I listened to that, I realised how much I had been influenced to think about the trial in a certain way by what was going online instead of what was happening in the courtroom.
And what was going online, am I right in thinking, was not actually a general view across the, you know, people around the world. A lot of it originating from specific troll farms who were having this inordinate influence.
It's a brilliant podcast. If you want to just listen to the first episode, you'll get the gist of it. And it just really does cover how you cannot trust what you see online the way maybe we could when the internet first came about. It has completely shifted. It is the Wild West. It is not safe. And one thing I said, I saw a post about the media, and that, you know, something about the media can print what they want and there's no recourse if they get it wrong. And it's not, that's why you have to trust what you see online. It's obviously the opposite. And like, I would worry about that kind of thing because, you know, media make mistakes and you can make complaints to the press council if you see those mistakes, and they will publish apologies. But social media can say what they want, and social media companies are like, well, it doesn't violate our guidelines, and it actually does quite well. And okay, also, anytime you see something online that makes you feel angry or upset or emotional, just treat it with a little bit of scepticism, because that is what they do. They try and get at your feelings.
Mark Little comes in here and he talks about just take that pause first before, you know, your brain reacts. Bridget, so they what has brought this conversation up again is of course Natasha O'Brien and her advocacy, but also a general messy story that's going on around the Defence Forces. Now, you picked a piece by Laura Roddy and Michael McNiff in the Sunday Times.
Yes, indeed. And I think it shouldn't take Natasha O'Brien to hit the streets and her story for this issue to be front and centre. But she did, and good things will come out of it now because she did. And she's been through an extraordinary trauma. I mean, the attack on her. And what was interesting was she was attacked for standing up for two men on a street in Limerick, and she was trying to stop this guy being homophobic. So she just got hammered for this. I think we now know that over the last 2 years there's 68 cases broadly of Defence Force personnel being before the courts, but that can be for anything, and it is a very small proportion. But I think the bottom line is
it's less than 1%.
Yeah,
right?
But what I think is important is if you're a guard and you are even suspected of a serious crime, you're immediately on leave or suspended. And the law needs to change that happens within the Defence Forces. But also, obviously, there needs to be a cultural shift in the Defence Forces. But I don't think it's just the Defence Forces. It's in our society. Time and time and time again, there's a horror, an event, and then people say never again, and there is a never again. There is again.
Yeah.
So it's a constant, constant struggle, and I think it has to be called out. Light has to be shone on it. And in fact, one of the ways is if you had more women in politics, that would be better, because then you would begin to address the educational stuff. On the whole question of the internet, I mean, I'm pretty active on Twitter, and I just instantly block if I'm abused. I block. I don't I don't engage, I block, but I am astounded at if I say anything that people object to. And it's usually unnamed people, so cowards hiding behind.
Yeah. I can't believe you're still on social media. I'm not on anything.
Well,
I mean, I'm just on Instagram. That's about it.
Well, I actually, there are parts of it that are you know, I love the poetry and the culture. And so there's a, it's
yeah,
not,
like it, life. It's a medium. There are good things and bad things. It has its uses. Yeah. Yeah. Listen, we I need to get to Aer Lingus. Dan, like, it does feel like people throwing shapes across the papers today, and basically there's clearly this narrative being pushed out there that I think Aer Lingus is a minnow within AIG and that the pilots have bitten off more than they can chew and everything, but it does seem fairly intractable right now, and people are getting more and more annoyed about this.
Obviously, particularly when it affects people's holiday plans and travel plans and costs them a lot of money. Look, I'm always extremely reluctant to comment on industrial relations. There are two sides to any of these things. But that point about Aer Lingus being a very, very small part of a very big entity is something. And I say this as somebody who actually opposed the sale of the Irish government's stake in Aer Lingus 10 years ago, because I feel that it's such a strategic imperative to have connectivity for an island, that having some government role in that sector is important. But that went ahead and happened. And now, as I say, you know, Aer Lingus is a tiny business. My fear is that, you know, could these guys turn around and say, look, we're just going to wind up Aer Lingus. It's not worth our while. It's causing too much trouble. And that would be really, really bad for this country.
Bridget?
I agree entirely with Dan on this. I think the 24% is an extraordinarily big demand. It's a big ask. And
pilots in American airlines, where there is a shortage of pilots in America, I believe, but they're getting 34%, 40%. I think in BA, they've got 24%, also part of AIG. And the pilots are saying, this is to make up. There's been 25% inflation in the last 4 years.
I fully accept the inflation issue. But the danger is if the demand is too high, you actually then just spiral wage inflation. So, but also the core point that Dan made is that Aer Lingus is part of a conglomerate, and how the conglomerate responds to this will determine the outcome for Aer Lingus. It's very small. It's less profitable than the other parts. So I think it'll be decided on the numbers. Now, they are going into the Labour Court tomorrow, and it would be better for Aer Lingus and for the pilots, in my view, if they could come to a settlement.
But do you think off-ramps might be more on people's minds going in there tomorrow than they have been heretofore?
I simply have no way of knowing one way or the other. But I think if the pilots were wise, they should think about, if they take this to the brink, they're the weaker force if they take it to the brink.
Grania.
As are workers always in industrial disputes, though. I mean, and workers do get pay increases despite being the weaker force in industrial disputes. I think that the most important comparator here is British Airways, a 24% increase. And if there a big thing is being made of the operating margin.
This is in Ellie Donnelly's piece.
In the Sunday Business Post. And Aer Lingus is at 9.9% operating margin, 10% at BA. So that is I think a significant indicator. Now, obviously, the other figures, total revenue and operating profits, are different. But
Grania,
I think
before we go to a break, can I just ask you, how problematic is this for the government at this point, and does it become a bigger problem for the next week? Is it a growing problem for them all the time?
I think they are worried about the level of unhappy people who are going on their holidays. And when I was speaking to people in Dublin Airport, it's mostly families who are saying, great if we can go on holiday. We don't really mind if we're delayed getting back, but we don't want to explain to our kids that the one holiday a year we're going on is cancelled and why that is. And that is significant. Think about how the passport delay issue is such a big story every year. This is like this times 1,000. So it is a big one for the government. And I think they're pretty limited in what they can do. They can't make Aer Lingus compromise. They can't make the pilots compromise. So they're going to have to just hope for the best.
Okay, we need to take a break. Margaret E. Ward, Professor Bridget Laffin, Grania Nye and Dan O'Brien staying with us.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Our panel still with us, Margaret E. Ward, Professor Bridget Laffin, Gronin EA, and Dan O'Brien. Dan, the French are going out to vote today, and it's quite a dramatic situation there, isn't it?
I think it's extremely dramatic. Le Monde, one of the big papers there, says that they risk tearing down everything they've built for 2.5 centuries. In other words, since they got rid of the monarchy and became a republic with the French Revolution. That's how big Le Monde sees it. It's hard to get across, you know, what's going to happen in France. By every indication is that their parliament will be full of the extremes from the hard right and the hard left. So far, they have an electoral system that underrepresented the extremes. So they don't have a proportional representation electoral system. And that has meant that there's been underrepresentation. Now it's changing and it's flipped. And now it looks like a big majority of all the parliamentarians in France, you know, one of the most important countries in Europe, arguably still a very important country globally, a nuclear power, is going to have a bunch of extremists in its parliament. This is, in my view, the French election, for the first time ever, is more important for us here in Ireland than the British election going on at the same time.
Okay, so consequences. Both extremes basically have plans that could cause that kind of contagion. Are we back to there, like across Europe financially?
Well, Liz Truss got into government, set out a plan that was the markets didn't believe, and she was out of power within a month. Now, both sides, the two extremes, have put out plans that France is already in a difficult spot in terms of its public finances. If they were to implement, if either one of those groups were to get a majority and implement it, there could very well be a panic. And then, as you say, the difference between Britain wasn't in a monetary union. France is in a monetary union with 19 other countries, including us. So if there's a panic, a Liz Truss-type moment in France, that will spread to the rest of the Eurozone. And that is something to really, really worry us, because there are other countries in the Eurozone
that are
really... And that
is not being overdramatic. We're back to, like, bonds, runs on banks, debt, all that kind of stuff that we thought we were past.
There is a potential for that. I'm not saying it's going to happen. With the European Central Bank is more active than it originally was, plus Irish public finances are in a much better position, so we're unlikely to feel that contagion immediately. But certainly there is now a risk of things, of a financial crisis coming out of France's election.
Yeah, sometimes people say that the French get sense in the second round, Bridget, that they have their kind of French say initially and then the minds get focused.
That usually works, but it would require that some of the people going into the second round, a high proportion of them are sane and sensible, and that might not be the case. So the centre is, Macron has squeezed the centre and taken a huge gamble, and his gamble is going to fail. And I agree with Dan. I would say there's the economy, but I think the institutions of the Fifth Republic, we should never forget France has had five republics, yeah, is at stake. Now, I think we would probably see tomorrow the spread starting to go, whether that impacts on the second round. I'm not sure that we're back.
When you say the spread's starting to go, so right now...
France's spreads will increase vis-a-vis...
This is their interest rate spreads, yeah. Yeah. Okay.
So that will happen pretty quickly, I would have thought. And whether that then impacts on the second round or whether it's too late.
And they have this kind of almost TikTok Taoiseach kind of character. You would not compare him in any way with our own TikTok Taoiseach, but he does seem to be... kind of, there's that Trumpian air of like celebrity. He's 28. He will be not Jean-Marie Le Pen. He will be Marine Le Pen. He will be the Prime Minister. He's 28. Yeah. Very slick. Social media, selfies, yeah, all that kind of thing.
Relatable. But of course, they might not get a majority, in which case you have chaos. And that's whether or not Macron would then try and govern with a technocratic government. But Macron took a gamble, an arrogant gamble, that he shouldn't have taken. Now, it could be that her chances for the next presidential election were strong anyway. Mm. But he thought that he could persuade France on his own, almost. And the people around him were shocked not just others, but the people.
So did not realize how unpopular and out of touch he was regarded. Yeah, sure, I knew that over here. Exactly. We all knew it. Like,
his disapproval level is 71%. Now that's pretty high, but. And I would add one more issue to the soup, and that is not only have we a potential destabilised France, we have an extraordinarily weak chancellor in Berlin. Extraordinarily okay. weak.
Grainne, give us a quick check-in on what's going on in the UK elections. Mm. We were so busy ourselves this week, people mightn't have been paying full attention, but dramatic stuff as well this week.
Yeah, this is like my news dessert. I go in and check on what's happening over
okay,
in the UK.
Okay, a bit of low consequences stuff
yeah,
for
exactly.
you. Yeah,
exactly. It's like, you know, it's what is going on over there this week. And it's great to read. There's a piece in the Sindo today about Nigel Farage's Reform Party, and he's had to make excuses for why a candidate of the Reform Party, formerly the Brexit Party, was filmed by an undercover Channel 4 reporter saying making racial slurs about Rishi Sunak, and then also saying migrants should be used as target practice. Now, he has, after initially apologising, gone back and actually made a complaint to the Electoral Commission or Watchdog in the UK and said, actually, this was election interference and this guy is actually an actor and we are all very suspicious about the
no,
whole thing.
No, the guy was not alone. If anyone saw the Channel 4 stuff, there yeah. were parts of people who seemed to be Farage's inner sanctum who had titles and positions in the party speaking in appalling ways as well.
I think this kind of second round of responding to it, very different from the first where he apologised, suggests Nigel Farage is a bit worried about where the election is going for his party, though he is polling better than the Lib Dems at the moment, his party. But also he U-turned on supporting the TUV and that caused chaos in Northern Ireland because he supported Sammy Wilson and Ian Paisley Jr. But it's that kind of level of stuff is coming out every day. You know, The Observer has some great pieces in it, one of whom was from a Tory candidate about their chances of maybe salvaging some of that very depressing polling numbers that they are looking at, you know, Labour looking to get over 400 seats in Parliament. And they said, well, you know what they say, it's always darkest before it's pitch black. You know, that level of cynicism yeah. about what is going to happen. And then, you know, you have some great bits of colour, like someone did a poll, I think it was ITV, about voting intention based on the preferred drink of people have. So, you know, they have like, you know, lager and wine and everything. And the only cohort of drinkers that the Tories have left supporting them are the sherry drinkers. And as someone, as a colleague said to me, when you've lost the Prosecco drinkers, you know, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So there's all this kind of great stuff.
I saw people are pivoting now to saying, well, yes, Labour are going to win, but like if their majority is too big, it won't be good for them. I think when you're
most
left to that.
Working class cabinet in years as well, The Observer saying, if Labour get in.
Bridget, Tommy Gorman and Mihála Mórhártig, you knew or connected to both of them?
Well, I would have met both of them, and I think Ireland lost two great men this week, and it was the outpouring, but also what they meant in our society. And Mihál died at 93, a life well lived. He brought Kerry to the rest of the country. And Tommy Gorman died tragically very young. But yet, if you look at Tommy Gorman's career, it was extraordinary. And the emphasis very much this week has been on how he brought the peace process to the television screens. But he was also an excellent European correspondent in an earlier period.
So, and at a time when we possibly needed Europe explained to us by a trusted voice as well.
By a trusted voice. And I know from an extended family member who had a very rare form of cancer that Tommy was extraordinarily helpful in terms of advice and because of his Swedish experience. He gave that he had cancer for a long time, but he used it to help so many different people that we will never know. It's very yeah. private. So an extraordinary man, and they were the best of us, both of them.
Yeah, absolutely. When there's a letter in the Sunday Independent today, when Mihála O'Shea told Mihála Mórhártig that Paddy O'Shea was dead, he saw Tán Rí Imithe Uinn.
I think it was Riella.
Yeah, yeah.
Riella.
Okay. That's it for today. Thanks very much to our panel, Margaret E. Ward, Professor Bridget Laffin, Grainne Inniu and Dan O'Brien. We just have room for a quick clip, I think. The big story on today's front pages is, of course, the end of Dublin's reign as All-Ireland football champions after their surprise loss to Galway yesterday. This clip from the ecstatic Galway Bay FM commentary yesterday at the final whistle is doing the rounds this morning. So just to give us a boost at the end of the panel.
Sweet Mother of Jesus, they have pulled off the unthinkable. Forget about Taylor Swift. Shake it off in the Aviva and come over here to Croke Park because you're witnessing the West away. Galway Abu!
I'm glad I don't have to follow that. We'll go to the newsroom and Kate Egan.